July the 3rd, 1998, with J. Arthur Thomason, T-H-O-M-A-S-O-N.
John Arthur.
John Arthur Thomason, done by Frank Hilton. This is the deals of your truth, that rosters and when you were registered. Best that I could determine. What do you remember about being a Boy Scout?
The Boy Scout program was the best program for a young man. It was organized and had discipline. Most of the parents appreciated if they get their boys into the program because of the age and time of life that these young men were beginning to grow into young manhood, and the various troops with their leaders would work real hard to try to get the different boys in the community into their program who might enhance that program for their group, because there was a great deal of competition between the the groups.
Yeah, there were several troops here in town, like when you joined.
Yes, and we had Mr. Pouncey was the leader of the community in the Boy Scout program. He was probably the local director. I can't remember whether they had a Comanche Trail Council at that time or not.
No, the Con Valley Council.
More memory come back. And we had Lampasas, and we had Brownwood, and what other?
San Saba and Goldway.
San Saba and Goldway.
Comanche, Steve.
Comanche and Steve. I remember boys in the camp from those various places now that you recall in my memory. These young men getting together in a camp was a great event, an exciting event for us. But the Boy Scout program was essential in the development, in my opinion, of the natural physical and mental resources of the country. I think it guided young men in a correct direction that their families, mothers and fathers, more desired. Then we have a group of parents today that apparently care very little about that.
Well, tell me about you as a Boy Scout. What do you remember about being a young Boy Scout? Because you got in the late 30s, 1930.
In the beginning, Mr. Wilkes served on the school board with my father. And he had a Boy Scout troop, and my dad would come and tell me about the Boy Scout troop and how interested Mr. Wilkes was. And he had an older son named Jeff Thomas Wilkes, who took care of the young squirts more so. Mr. Wilkes was an older man. And so it came about that Mr. Wilkes influenced the fact that I joined the Scouts. Now, my mother was active in that direction because she wanted us in some type of organized play. And we lived on the creek, down Willis Creek.
Willis Creek.
About a block from the creek. And we played up and down and learned a lot of things from 9, 10, and 11, 12 years old down there. About nature and life and swimming and other things. But the program, Boy Scout program, came along as a guiding, disciplining, that most of the boys that wanted to have an extra something to do would try to get joined. Now, we didn't have TV and we didn't have picture shows as we know them so easily attended at the time, and they were difficult to get to town to. You'd have to ride a jitney to go to town to go to a picture show if you didn't have an automobile there to drive. You know, those Model T's were usually driven by the head of the house to work and back and trips and travel. But anyway, radio was scratchy. You could turn in Dallas and various, but that's not much entertainment to a young man that's kind of feisty and about that age. So the Boy Scout program gave him a chance to go somewhere on Friday night and play. And that was the beginning of the feeling that you had somewhere to go and play, organize.
You were in Troop 7 at Central United Methodist Church.
And yes, and it was just wonderful that they gave us the opportunity.
Y'all meet in the basement?
We met on the basement, and we had a large pad that probably was about 10 by 20. You'd call them wrestler's pads or something right now to protect from falling. Thicker than a rug, much thicker than a rug. And we had games that we played that were not real rough, but then they would be active and be some contact very little. But it was like capture the flag and quick with the hands, quick with the feet type games. And
steal the bacon.
And steal the bacon and a few things. Mostly I was trying to think of steal the bacon. That was really a strong one. We really worked hard at that. And but Jeff Thomas Welch would have us down 4 or 5 minutes of the program. Because that's, at that age, it's impossible to get the attention for any young man more than 5 minutes on one subject, I think. And probably it's that way now, in my experience with my grandchildren. It gave me the opportunity to participate. And whether I wanted it or not, I received a certain amount of discipline, which most of them did and really needed it and wanted it. I think the children are missing the opportunity to not Boy Scout. This led to going to camp Billy Gibbons. When we found that Scout Billy Gibbons was an activity that we could also join into, and the bait was getting away from home. There's seldom any of us ever been any further than
Willis Creek.
Well, I'm saying Willis Creek, and maybe we'd been to Comanche once. I doubt that. Oh, I went back to Ennis one time, and my dad drove us back to my grandpa and grandma in a Model T Ford. That trip took all day. But anyway, back to the Boy Scout program, by encouraging us to do merit badges, we learned things that other boys and girls in the community and neighborhood that we were associated with didn't pick up on. They didn't have that direction. So we felt good about that. I don't try to say superior, but we felt good that it was a result of what we were doing. The group that we played with and participated beyond play and merit badge work, outside activities where we would do archery contests and
archery was real popular then, wasn't it?
It really was.
Everybody make bows and arrows and had contests all over the council, and
very few boys and girls in 1930 had enough money to buy equipment. We made our own equipment. And somewhere in my collectibles, somewhere, I've still got my old bow that I made. And it took a minute out. It was made of lemon wood, which we would buy about 2-inch square, about 4 feet long maybe, and we would take a rasp and with one of them to look at.
Yeah.
Something to look at. And an older boy would show us how to work that rasp. We'd work that bow down into the proper widths and the proper upward slight curl to it. Now, to make that bow curl, of course, it was a matter of putting a string on it. And we made our own string. I was thinking about that last night. We would take a flax-type string, preferably, and we would either knit the string, or we would plait that string, or we would twist that string, and we would hang it on a rock on it to stretch it. And then as we stretched it, we'd go out every day or whenever we got around to it, and we would wax it with beeswax. And my memory is that getting that string ready was hardest work of making that bow. Because when you'd put it on there, if it wasn't stretched right and perhaps made right, the minute you pulled it back, it stretched out and it wasn't any good. We had to appreciate what the Indian went through to learn
how to make
a bow and an arrow work. The
Archery was very important to us.
That was a picture of a group of kids with all their bows, the reason I was showing that to you.
Well, that would be many more kids than we had in our program, probably about two of us, three of us in each troop. Maybe an 8 or 9 or 10 would be in those weekly or once a month archery contests. And I'll tell you now that Lowell Pouncey and Gaither Browning and there was a German boy, tall, I can't remember his name now, was in the Scouts. And he was excellent in that area, and one or two others. Then there's always one from Lampasas or Gulfway or somewhere that who would pick it up and want to come to them, and they'd get their way up here. Sometimes it's summer ride to get up here, and the daddies let them do it in those days. It's unusual.
Yeah.
Think about it. But we had a lot of fun, and that was educational. In the course of going up into the Boy Scout climb to the seeking the eagle, we all made a little progress as it went along, and mine was too much for fun, and I didn't get mine going good, but I did eventually get up to one or two at merit badges of being an eagle. And then I went playing football, and my Friday nights were occupied, and I dropped out of the scout program in the sense that I wasn't attending meetings anymore, but I did wind up, if I can remember, since I've been out of the Boy Scout, I made an effort, sincere effort, and I thought I was doing it all those years, of sending my dues down for years just the same, because I appreciated how much it meant. Now, talking about what it meant to me is I could talk all day on it, because I'm just that much sold on it. My son, Jim, was in it, and he went right through the Eagle Scout as quick as they'd let him do it, the number of equal weeks that they allowed him to do it in. And Brian Healer was one of my good friends and lived in the neighborhood, and I encouraged him, and he was quick and intelligent and wanted that program and went into it, and he was in the Heart of the Air and all that stuff. Now, my son Jim was in the drum corps with Pepper and his group and all of the things they did, and they went to Colorado and things.
To the Jamboree.
And Jamboree, and we saw that Jim got to go on because it was a great program, and Brian did the same thing. So those two I followed, see, and supported that program because my kin folks and my close friends were in it. And Mr. Pouncey lived down the street, and you know, I see him all the time, and I did work for Mr. Pouncey as an accountant, and we kept in touch with things. And Mr. Quirrell came along, and even after Mr. Quirrell took over, Mr. Pouncey would help any way he could. And no telling how much time he gave to it, and no telling how much money he put, that is a few dollars here and a few dollars there, when no one had any money, but he did it for the boys. He had two boys, and it was an investment in them too. But I'll say that after we all grew up, in 1940, the war came, World War II, and all my age, or 20 to 22 years old. And everyone went but John Wood and myself and a few others who weren't qualified physically to go. We did things like aluminum drives and bond sales and brush pickups and whatever it is that they called on us to do. And John and I took our Boy Scout work and carried it over into the JCs and kept the JCs, he and I and a couple of others, about five of us on stayed here during the war. All of that background we had as a little organization that we could see and discipline helped us get into the JC programs and be leaders in the JC programs. That's where your Boy Scout program pays off in the long run, is in your down the road finding and discovering that you're in a particular position, and you stop and think, why is it that I did this? And then if you just look back a little bit, you were trained here and you were training there and you were disciplined here and you were doing these different things. And you begin to appreciate the Scouts more and more as you get older. Now, the boys came back, most of them, from the war. I lost half a dozen friends that didn't. Most of us were Boy Scouts that I can remember my association continuing on those years. Those that came back and discussed their experiences in the war. In the conversations, more than a third of the time with the boys who had been in the Boy Scouts, would enumerate something that they had learned in the Boy Scout that it was a survivor situation as far as they were concerned. Their swimming program, it was great, you know, and they pushed that senior lifeguard program. Coach Gilliam was a great, great coach, and he was our coach in the senior lifesaving program down at Count Billy Gibbons and for the whole town. He's Red Cross instructor here, you know, for years. And the swimming saved a couple of them, for sure. They had to bail out at Salerno, had to swim ashore. Boats got blown up. And then one or two of my friends were bailing out of airplanes in the mountains back into Italy and somewhere back in there, and they had to survive, and they couldn't afford to turn themselves in to anyone. And so they were managing, they could survive from some of their expenses. I've had these conversations with these boys, so I know that being prepared is a wonderful program. It sure paid off with some of those guys when the time came. And of course, in my life and work and working in the JC, taking part in activities in the city and willing to take the responsibility of being on some type of an official or otherwise or head of some committee, well, the Boy Scout program gave you the most confidence, that's what it is, the confidence to go ahead. And where a lot of people, unfortunately, didn't have that background, and some of them couldn't, with great talent, couldn't achieve what a Boy Scout, apparently with his background, could do. Now, that briefly said, when I got into the Boy Scouts, it hit me a lot, helped all my friends. It proved to be in all my life a thing that made me support the Boy Scout program to this day. And anyway, I think that it could be encouraged that I could help in what area I can help. However, at 80, I'm not much help.
When you went to Camp Billy Gibbons, you said the first time you went down there was to help build the dam.
Right.
Would you tell me a little about building that dam? How it came about, how you got involved with it?
They wanted to have volunteers who would go down and work in the hot sun and help build the dam or the mess hall or the camp and get it ready.
When do you remember when this was? Was this after they'd already run a season of camp, or was it? Don't know.
I'm apparently about 14 or 15 years, 15 years old here.
So that would make it about
33. And of all the people that are in this picture, only myself and my brother are still living. I'm on the end, on the bottom here, the tall one, the white shirt. And my brother is one, two, three, fourth from me, going to my right on the picture.
Yeah, you've got a list of them on the back.
And
is he still here in Brownwood?
No, he's in Wimberley, Texas.
Wimberley.
And he served in the military, Air Force, when he. And, but he's got four girls and a great number of descendants, and they're doing great. But we too. Now we went to this camp under the guidance of Mr. Pouncey, asking us to take part. And a very strong influence in my life was a very, very old, what I call highly moral fellow, very well-trained background. Mr. Sam Morris and his wife had four children, I think. And one of them was named Harvey. And Harvey is standing next to Mr. Pouncey, and he made a medical doctor and served in World War II, and then came back and lived and died in Elgin, Texas. And he volunteered and urged us, that we knew the boys well, to go. And John Wood and I had fished together and known each other for years. His daddy was a game warden, and he lived up the street from me. Then Gil, I'd known the Gil family, off and on. They were old-timers here, and they were in the fire chiefs and fire department for years, and here, and Dan was one of them, and he had served in World War I, I think, veteran. And he was about the best cook you ever saw for cooking red beans. And this other boy is named Archer or something. Larry Hargrove, maybe, Clarence Kenny. Paul Daly, Clarence Kenny, James Thomason, Larry Christmas, Hargrove. Well, I'm working from the wrong side there. Merlin Acar, yeah. I think his mother was a chiropractor, or her his father was. These other boys in there, I knew very well. You have them named there. I can say just James and I, or Phil Lennon. We went to, very naively went down to have a summer vacation and wound up working our tail off, you know, in the hot sun, about like it is right now, in that riverboat, constructing this dam. Now, Mr. Pouncey went over to Brady, where he knew a man, a family, that were known as rock masons, one of them. His name was Mr. Archer. And Mr. Archer came over to supervise our work. And he showed us how first to clean off the base, and we chipped and crowbarred and cleaned, and he found a base that was solid. By the way, that dam's still there, and it's going to be there for another 100 years. And I'll tell you why. He had some steel rods cut about that long.
About 2 feet.
And he gave us some bits that were about that tall. And he gave us some sledgehammers. And one would hit the top of that bit while the other one held it in the hole we were going to make in that bedrock. And then you would turn it because it had little things sticking down like this on it.
Star drill.
You'd turn it and hit it again. Turn it and hit it again. Now, after the first hour, we all learned one thing, that the man that was sitting there holding that thing sure was at the mercy of the man swinging that bar. And young people in those days, a little bit wild about, you know, they couldn't control their muscles too good, and they loved to swing too far and get mid it and break your arm. So we had a rule that says, you hit that bar 10 times and I'll hold it, and then I hit that bar 10 times and you hold it. So it worked real good. Nobody got hurt. And we learned to control the downswing in such a way that if it glanced off, you know, we could take it away from the man's wrist. Anyway, we drill holes about every 2 feet or so in there. And then he had some cement hauled out. We hauled it out in the old truck. And we hauled some sand from a sandbar down toward the San Saba, which is down the river, about a half a mile. And we had a mortar out here, up board thing sitting in a high place. We poured that sand and that cement, and we didn't put any gravel in it that I remember, because this thing is solid cement, and the gravel has a tendency to cause it to break up sometimes if it's pressured like that. But anyway, we had this big old square thing, and we had those holes out there, and we mixed that sand and cement. And then he would come over there with a hod, they call it, a big old square thing, and hold it up and put a bunch on there. And or we'd have a wheelbar and take it to him sometimes. And we called it a wheelbar in those days. But he would take that trowel he had, and he would just beautifully do that work where we'd lay a rock on top. He would chip those rocks to fit what he was doing. So this appeared to be a beautiful rock wall when he finished. And it was just, look how level it is. Mm-hmm. The water is evenly flowing. It's in a little bitty low place, but it's evenly flowing all the way across there. That man was a real artist. Before.
How long did it take you all to build the dam?
It took 2 weeks or more, maybe 3. We went down a little earlier than usual to build that dam. We may have been down there once. But,
that was before camp that summer?
Mm-hmm.
Did you go to camp after the dam was built?
Mm-hmm.
Was that your first year to go to camp?
I don't remember.
Don't remember.
I wished I could remember. I thought I had gone to camp the first year that this was a camp.
That was in 31, if it was.
I thought I had. I have gone to camp before this. Because, see, I'd been in the program and been down there, and I wanted to go back. I remember that. I just can't remember what year. The camp records are not available, I don't guess. Well,
it had to be before 35, because that was the last time you registered in the troop. So, and you started in 30, but whether you went to camp that first summer or not, in 31, after you became a scout.
Almost.
Well, you would have been 13 if you'd have been 14 when you built the dam.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember what you did the first year you go to camp? Did you just swim in the river? No dam? No backup water?
There was just a blue hole of water down there.
How about the dining hall?
The dining hall,
Look like that?
Was there was something else. There was a thatched.
Look at this.
There was a thatched. Well, yeah.
That's 31. That was the first year they had the dining hall.
Here's Mr. Wells right there.
They don't have any of that identified, which is something you're going to do for me.
I'm going to help you.
Well, then maybe you're in the picture.
Might be. We thought it was going to be than it was the year before. Now that's just about my memory, and I can't remember whether I went the year before or not. I might find something in my paper that'll tell me that.
In other words, the year before there was no. They show that as being 1931, which had been the first year they had summer camp at Billy Gibbons. And then in 32, Guy Quirrell became the scout executive, and Billy Gibbons died. He died before they had the second camp.
Well, I'll tell you what. I went to the first one then because, I say that, he came to the camp.
All right, then he would have been 31, 1931.
He came to the camp, and let me tell you, he was a little man, about 5'8" or 9".
Huh.
Very short. He had a long white beard. And he came down to talk to us on the Sunday after we'd had a camp. No, on the opening day of camp. Sorry about that. I believe that was everyone we had were coming in on Sundays, and they were going to start the camp on Monday. Some of them came in on Monday morning, and we had some kind of a program, and he stood up and talked to us, and I'm so tall, I remember how short he was, and such a fine-looking person. Straight up as he could be, and made his talk in a very quiet voice. And he told us about coming to the country. He told us that he had walked, I don't remember from where, with his sheep and brought them to this part where he had arranged to acquire the land. I don't know whether it was preemption by matter of moving in and using the land and then paying the state or county or the state, or whether he could buy it. At one time, I believe, he said he cost 25 cents an acre to buy it. There's a lot of money put together. So he may have done another thing. He may have leased it. He may have just rented it. He may have done it. And, of course, we were interested in outlaws and Indians and things. And we had located some Indian paintings on a bluff across from the camp. And, well, someone had located them for us and told us where they were. But he came and impressed us, because he wanted us to have a good camp, and he was glad that he had the facility for us, and you know, wished us well, and he was a real nice guy. But now, if that would mean probably that I went to the first camp, because I remember him distinctly coming down and welcoming us at that.
So he died in March of 32, March 17th, and they had the second camp in 32.
Well,
so that
might have been in the second camp.
It would have had to have been the first camp. He never made it to the second camp.
Right.
He died before they had the
second
camp.
Oh, yeah, March. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, I remember. Yeah. So I'm glad you mentioned that, because I didn't have any way of establishing what you want to
What do you remember about Camp Billy Gibbons in the early days? What did y'all do? I know you went swimming.
Well, there was an organized program. And you would be up, I'm going to say at 6 o'clock, at least by 6 o'clock. Now, camp leaders and camp cooks and camp people were out banging pans and doing things and walking through the woods and getting ready to do things. We can remember that, you know, right in the mornings when you're trying to get up but don't want to get up. You can hear all that rustling going on. And the few animals that were around that were leaving the area would leave. And so you had a little activity going on just at the false dawn, you know, kind of. And then the bugle would go up. And it would announce that way to get up. And there had several bugle calls. One time I was a big one, but don't pin me down on that. By the way, I still have the bugle.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. And if we have a museum, we might see about getting that into the museum. It's an old army bugle. Came from, I think, the...
Recording.
know.
Okay, we're recording now, so let's go. You were talking about Billy Gibbons coming down and talking, and how well you remember him.
Remember the incident, and that I was highly impressed by an elderly veteran of the Indian War, like we used to call it, talking to those old-timers. Many a time in the 1930s, we had a number of older men who had come to the country back in the Civil Wartime with young people, and they would talk to us young people sometimes, or we could listen in on the conversation.
Yeah.
So he was held our attention, and he was a very dignified gentleman, and was very generous in allowing us to transport ourselves across his ranch, which was about 12 miles from Richmond Springs, the worst road that you ever saw in your life. The camp was in a beautiful spot of tall pecan trees, mostly, I think, located on a slight alluvial plain there on the south bank of Brady Creek. And that dam was placed just above where you would cross the river with a vehicle. Saw very few cars in those days, mostly wagons and horses once in a while, a Model T truck or an old Chevrolet truck or something would come through the country. The camp site was simply a beautiful place for a young man to be in an outdoor activity. We had a wide creek bed, a couple hundred yards wide, it seems at least 100 yards wide, of white rocks out there that you'd have to cross over and walk on until you got to the stream part, which is on the other side. The stream was for miles just clear water running in once in a while accumulating puddles or ponds and potholes and things in the creek, and then now and then a larger hole like the one we dammed up to make a better swimming hole. The only other deep hole within that area for 5 miles was where they moved the camp to later on, upstream for 5 miles. They call that Blue Hole when I was a kid. We walked up there once or twice. Long ways in that creek bottom walking on those old hot rocks. But we'd walk and fish along and walk and go up and take a look at it, and it was pretty wild country. You never saw anything but fox and deer and coon, and at one time we saw a cougar, but they were common in those days. And boy, when we go to camp and us kids from the city would hear that old cougar screaming back over there, it just raised the hair on the back of your head. 12-year-old boy, never been in the country. But anyway, the camp was very fortunate that I made the first one. I became very enthusiastic about it, and then went to the next two. Started playing football then and got away from Boy Scouts some, and Friday nights being occupied with other things, basketball and track. But I kept up with the Boy Scouts, and like I said,
You remember any funny things that happened in camp?
Yeah. One of the funny things that was frightening to me in the first camp I went on, we had these areas that the leaders would pick out for us, or we'd pick out as a place for our campsite. And we had to have in mind that we were going to build one that would win the contest of being the best, because they would come out and inspect you every day and grade you, and then at the end of the time you'd have the best or the worst or whatever. And we all vied to try to make that the best. And we'd take rocks and bring them out of the creek bed and whitewash them, and we would take the weeds out, you know, and cut the grass, and almost had to cut the grass with a pocket knife because we sure didn't have any lawnmowers. But we'd make a pretty nice area for our camp, and we'd organize the cots in rows, and really in a business-like manner. The first night that we were down there in my first camp, there were not a lot of us in that particular group, maybe five or six. And so when we went to bed the first night, I was lying there listening to the crickets, the locusts, the old panther, painter we call him in those days, screaming all back in yonder and wondering if someone just making it up or was it real, but believing it was real. And it was real. And then you could hear animals that would go to water, they would cough and squall sometimes. I imagine there were a fox or
coon or
other animals. But anyway, the creek was running a little bit further from us.
The only time you could ever hear the creek rippling and running was when it got up a slight bit of a rise.
Anyway, I had gone to sleep,
and somewhere around midnight,
I wake up with a noise, because I'm edgy anyway, just a kid waking home like that. And I'm looking into the face of a big, black, ugly hole. Now, I'm lying on the bed there with on the side, and I'm
looking,
my eyes open, and here this hog is standing so tall that he's looking down at me. And of course, he made a grunting noise, and I'd never anticipated
anything like that
in the middle of the night, and I jumped up, swallowed him, and everyone in camp frightened the hog, and that hog went right through camp and took out every cock. It never stopped. It just turned every cock and just went on his way. So that was an experience that was rather funny and disrupting and
frightening and
something to remember, you know, the rest of my life, to wake up in the middle of the night, 12-year-old, and see a black, mean, vicious
looking
animal going to eat me.
But anyway,
that's Boy Scout experience.
And the next
funny event was that we were hauling rock
from the San
Saba River.
This Mr. Archer went
down preliminary to us going onto the creek,
and he
searched walking
all up down that Brady
Creek and all the way onto the San Saba,
where we were about a
half mile from it, and he located on the other side of the San Saba River a ledge of rocks, and he took a crowbar over there
when he went,
and he pried rocks
all over that country.
He found a ledge that would pry up enough rock that we could build this dam,
the ones he wanted.
So
he discovered the
place. Then it was a matter of us
being able to go get the
rocks. Well,
Mr.
Pouncey went up to Mr.
Archer.
No. To Mr. Billy Gibbons' house and asked him if he'd loan him a wagon
for us to have.
And John Wood was the mule skinner, and John was a good one. He knew how to handle
a mule or
horses. I can't remember now. I believe that we call it mule skinner, so I'm going to say they were mules.
And
he was about as stubborn as they were,
so he got along fine with those mules, and he could get a back wagon and go over there with a swamper, we call him. And the two of them would load those rocks in,
they'd pry up, the pry those rocks
out that leg,
and load them in that wagon, and then come back across the river. There's no crossing there, they just found their way across. Wasn't real high, probably 1 foot deep in places, maybe 2 feet deep in places. And they would be very careful
and come back.
Well, John Wood had to
go to town.
Every day, someone went to
town in a camp
truck, big truck, and they got bread
and ice
and any other things.
And tomato.
So every morning, someone
got up at
before daybreak,
got in that truck
with an assistant
or two,
whatever, and they went to town. 12 miles.
It took
2 hours
to drive
that road in that truck,
which
stayed in low gear all the
time. There was a
flat space that I can remember that we could run
it.
In fact, when we were on that truck on
occasion,
heavy,
we got off the truck.
It was too rough
to ride on
and walk. And we'd be 100 yards from the truck lots of times, and we could catch the truck
by just walking
a little faster. That's how slow the truck was. But we got back by 11 o'clock.
We'd bring ice.
Now, and we had an ice
hole.
We dug a pit. We put a big tarpaulin in the pit. We had a day or a half or 2 days of ice
always
in that pit.
And whatever we used
out of the pit,
we replenished.
We always had that day and a half
supply
worked out, because
we may not
be able to get the town and back for some reason.
And they
saw that we had that. Okay. You could put that tarpaulin back
over and lay some
boards on that, and you wouldn't have a drop of water on the bottom of those tarpaulins. It'd be that.
Ice
wouldn't melt down in the ground like that,
the way they had it.
It's amazing. And of course, it was in a
shady place
and the sun on it. Well, when John had to take the trip to town
in a truck,
Two Skillion drove the truck most of the time.
But John
made the. Hi, hello there, kid.
Okay, it's going fine now.
Well, the interruption was that my granddaughter brought my great-grandson in, and they were from Plano and are visiting us over the 4th of July, and John and Jeffrey, her husband, and Kim and Travis interrupted us, but for the record, that's what happened. Now, back to the
truck.
The truck. We would get off that truck and chase rabbits or throw rabbits or hunt arrowheads and just do any number of things rather than ride on that old truck. And then we'd catch it when it would start up the next little rise or hill. It'd just get back down in Grandma again. And we would get up and maybe ride up the hill, because we didn't want to walk up the hill in the hot sun, you know. But on those top of the hill deal, anyway, that was kind of inside the story. Back to the wagon. Mr. Billy Gibbons loaned us this wagon to haul that rock and the team, and all we had to do was feed the horses and water them and take care of them and put the harnesses on and take them off and take care of his wagon. So when John had to make the truck haul, and I'd made that truck haul myself several times, he turned it over to me, and I found someone to be my swamper. To this day, I can't remember who it was. And we were relieved from stacking rocks and drilling holes and making cement pods and dashes and going to get this tool and that thing and doing things. Mr. Archer was such a wonderful man. Someone had to find a place in heaven for him. He was a great guy and a great leader and just nice to us boys, and he was a hard worker and did a great job. But anyway, he was from Brady. I didn't make mention of it. And the Archer family are real well known and very well thought of in Brady. So anyway, we took off early to get the rock, and we went down this bank on the north side of the creek, and we went down to the mouth of the creek, and we crossed the San Saba River at the place where we saw the tire tracks crossing. And of course, instead of being able to dodge all the potholes, the wheels would once in a while get in a pothole. And we knew that that was a bad thing on that wagon. And we tried to pick out and mark those potholes where a wheel would just jump down all of a sudden. And we were doing pretty good about that, marking our way across. Now, John had been across the bench time. He just sort of knew by the way the water ran, you know, where the path was. We went across, loaded our wagon with all the rock that it would load, and they made us count rock so that it wouldn't overload the wagon or the horses. The only way we knew, because Mr. Archer knew about how much one rock weighed, and he said he will not put on more than so many rocks on there, and we did what he said. And as we got halfway through the loading, we look upstream there and look at the big old cloud of real huge cloud of rain and stormy stuff, and we hurried up, and we had the horses beginning to get a little restless, and we were getting a little restless, so we had to cross the stream, which was, oh, the flatbed of the stream would be 300 feet, 200 feet across, but the water stream would be maybe 50 or 60 feet across the watering. It would just kind of meander through the flat rock. And we were doing all right because we could see our tire tracks coming across on scarred on some of those rocks, and we remembered what we could. But all of a sudden, here comes a trash on the water and about a foot of water. And if you've never been down below where water is flooding towards you, you'll never know what it sounds like. It makes a hissing sound. You can just hear, I don't know why, but you can just hear a whispering hissing sound. Yeah. And that's enough to make the back of your head stand up with hair on it and all. But we are bothered and the horses are bothered. The water gets slightly muddy, and it gets about 6 more inches deeper by the time it's kind of run down, let alone us. And we've lost our trail, and it's just solid water between us and the bank, which is more than 2/3 the width of the riverbed. But very carefully urged the horses on, but we hit one of those potholes that just was wrong hole because it broke the wheel off. And here we are with the water rising and the horses getting restless and the wheel broken off the wagon. And the worst thing we thought about, well, what will Mr. Billy Gibbons say? We weren't worried about drowning as much as we were worried about, you know, what was he going to say. But all of a sudden, it dawned on us, we better get out of there. So first thing we did was unload the wagon, quick. And then, you know, it took us an hour to load it, but it didn't take 10 minutes to unload it to get it out of there. And we then had to worry about what are we going to do with the wagon sagging like that without breaking and tearing up the wagon. There's more potholes and twisting and turning, and the war horses are restless and jumpy. And with a little background in the scouting program and a little ingenuity on our part, we took the crowbar we had and jammed it on the side down to the ground. One of us lifted up the side of the wagon, we'd emptied the rocks out, and the other one jammed that crowbar down in there at an angle where it would rest it up, and then when we let it down through that hole, where we made a hole or found one or braced it against something, and then we got to looking around and we found out in the middle of the stream there some old posts that still had some barbed wire. Now, if I had that barbed wire today, it'd probably be very antiquable and collectible. But, we took that barbed wire, that's the only thing we had, and we wrapped that around part of the wagon and the axle. And so when the horses pulled it, all it did was just jump along when it would go down in the hole or come up, but it helped the wagon up. And we got to the bank without any further to do. But as I look back, that was a solid sheet of water across there, oh, probably not more than 3 feet deep. But it would have been enough to, for no experience that we had to us to handle it very well. We were just lucky enough to get out of there. Well, that's an experience that lasts you a lifetime, you know.
What happened to the wheel?
We put the wheel in the wagon. And took it home. And what we were worried about all the way after we saved the horses, we might say, and ourselves, we worried about what is he going to say, and were we going to have to pay for it, you know. Well, when we got back up to him, and we told Mr. Pouncey, what happened, or whoever we told. They said, that's all right, boys, you couldn't help it, we'll take care of it. And they told me how they did this. They went to town that night. They got a man up who made axles. Actually, in Richland Springs, they had an axle maker. Put lots of wagons in that country at that time. Remember, that's about 30 or 31. And asked him about what to do. And he had already made the axles on that old wagon to start with. He knew which wagon it was, the one with the green this or the red wheels or whatever. And he said, oh, I can make one if I can get the wood. And he sent to Brownwood, he phoned Brownwood, one of those old crank telephones, and they got a piece of oak that they sent down that night. Somebody brought it down, some Boy Scout, the father or someone made it a point to bring that oak down there. And the next day he worked, and his whole horse worked and made that axle. Recapped the thing and put another axle on under, and brought it down to us. And then down there had those little old hook deals, you know, and those screws and everything on. And they put it on, and we helped them. And they said, well, now, go ahead, boy. We thought you were going to take that wagon away from us, you know. We're going to have to haul those rocks one at a time, Mom. That's what they told us we were going to have to do. You know? Well, anyway, we had a great time in that program, and a little more education in that than we thought we were, than we chewed off, you know. But
y'all real proud when you finished the dance?
We were so proud of it that we had this picture taken that you see. And I'm very fortunate that I was able to get the names on the back of it. That I think someone helped a lot on that, because I couldn't remember two of the boys, but I remembered every one but two of them. And the camp had to have bread and ice every day. And other than that, we had a nurse each camp, or two, and they would volunteer and come down and stay, and they had a little medical tent, they called it. And you would go to this nurse for with any kind of sore, and there's lots of bruises and abrasions. To my memory, in all my scouting experience, I didn't know of no one who ever was hurt seriously in scout program. Now, one of the scout camps down there, I think it was the one after we built the dam, there was a flood. And for 2 days and two days and two nights, we were over there flooded, and I was on that camp.
Yeah, I've got the story in the book here on that, out of the newspaper.
John Wood and I decided that we would go across during that flood. We used better judgment back then.
Yeah.
But we took the canoe we had, walked it across those rocks, and went down to that blue hole where it would be wider and it'd be running smoother. And we stood there for about 20 minutes debating whether we were going to put that canoe in there and go across to bring some supplies that someone had brought us for something back to the camp. Now, we were, I think, reckless in the idea that we might do it, but we were older boys. And so we went down and changed our mind, and I'm glad we did, because the water was rushing down pretty good and it was a flood. And but people were worried on the other side. A lot of parents drove down and they'd wait over there in their cars, and people on our side, but we're perfectly safe, you know. And those rivers down there, they just run down in about two or three days. And that one ran out in a couple of days. And it was just an exciting experience for all concerned, parents, children, scout executives. But the coolest heads among them were probably the kids were having fun and didn't want to go back home anyway, and they were really having a ball.
Did you ever work on camp staff, or you just went to camp as a kid?
I don't think I ever acted any more than probably a subgroup leader. In other words, I probably had a job of looking after some of the camp work that we'd do, but Jeff Thomas Wilkes would handle the job, if I remember correctly, mainly. And he'd ask me to do things every now and then, because I was one of the larger boys.
You recognize that guy? That's at the new camp, Billy Gibbons, but is that John Gibbons? I couldn't quite figure out why we had that picture.
Well, that's the same man that's in that picture you showed me over yonder in that book. Here, I think. Or am I wrong?
Well, he looks like the same guy. I wonder if that's Brian Heeler then. Did he have a sister?
Yep. Lisa. She living here now.
I might be able to identify that.
You know, and that looks like Miss Heeler too.
She might be able to.
Lisa works at the Brown County Police Sheriff's Office.
Sheriff's Office?
Yeah. You can call her at Sheriff's Office and she'll tell you how to get there and you can show her these things. It sure does look like Amber Heeler. And that sure does look like Lisa, but it.
Well, she would know it.
It kind of looks like Brian, but I can't tell.
Yeah.
I knew Brian Moore after he was up around 9, 10, 11, 12 years old. When he lived right behind us.
Go ahead.
They taught us skills while we were at the camp because they would have merit badge programs going on, and a part of your week was to pass merit badges, and they encouraged us to earn one a day. And they wanted you to progress from what is the basic one?
Tenderfoot
to the
second class, and then merit badges. And I think you can earn up to 5 merit badges as a second class.
Yeah. Boy, that was going on a great deal down there. Well, every morning, I reviewed in my thinking last night about this interview. And I'm not going to hit it exact, but this is going to be about what our day was like. You had a beautiful call. You had to straighten up your cot then. And anything on the ground, let's get them organized. You couldn't leave the camp without having your part of the camp work done, that is, your bed. Maybe. And that's a little bit hard for a 12-year-old. His mama always made his bed, you know. It wasn't so much for me because, I don't know, it didn't bother me to have to do that. And then, and there weren't many sleeping bags. Mama sent a quilt and a blanket and a sheet and a pillow sometimes. It's so many times, believe it or not, that the boys would arrive at camp and they wouldn't have a pillow. They'd get everything but the pillow. Anyway, then there'd be a bugle call, sick call they call it. You go to your group later there when you get up, and if you're sick, then he'd say, when the sick call comes, you go to the tent. That was the next thing. And then the next was breakfast. Bugle call was for breakfast. All the rest of us that had stayed there walked in single file to breakfast together. And we were doing this in a disciplined manner. We were dressed and inspected by our group later, and we had to appear to be neat and clean. And I'll tell you an incident on shoe shining in a minute that was also pretty funny. After breakfast, we would immediately assemble out around the flagpole, wherever that was, or the meeting ground, or what would you call that, parade ground, maybe that's what they call it. We would organize in lines, and we would listen to the orders of the day, that is, the instructions on what the camp was going to be doing this day. Here, this program is over here, and that plane is over there, and by the way, they moved to this thing over here, and then we're not going to have that over there, getting everything organized. And tell us where to go under certain circumstances that might have been different.